All right, as we continue our fast downhill slope, I kind of laid out a little bit of a calendar outline last night to see if I could get through sort of a survey of some of the key figures of the Reformation before January. And so I'm not even going to tell you what that is because I'm not sure I'm going to make it. But nonetheless, I am really trying and hoping to kind of sort of rapid fire through some of these remaining periods of time leading up to the Reformation, and then turn the page in the new year and start a book study in 1 Corinthians. I'm really looking forward to getting into a book study. I don't know about you, but I mean, by the way, I'm grateful for the encouragement that I've received off and on through this study. I mean, many of you have been very kind in expressing your appreciation and enjoyment of the subject matter, but I can just tell you that trying to figure out what to cover and where to start and where to end. I mean, what we're going to talk about today, I mean, it's a pretty daunting task, and there's no way we can do the subject real justice because it's such a big, really academic subject that can be covered in a complete, you know, master's degree, or it can be covered certainly in several semesters of seminary. And we're trying to kind of just, you know, fire some shots over the bow as we come in here from Sunday to Sunday. So I'm really looking forward to as well getting into the text of Scripture more deeply and more specifically. So I'm motivated not just because I want to be finished, but I do want to be finished, I can just tell you. So I'm going to do my best to not allow that sort of that study and subject fatigue to come through in my teaching. It's funny, I teach a economics class of high school students here up at the high school, just one period of a high school economics class, and I had them do a presentation this past week, a group presentation, and you know, I critiqued them on not just content but on their presentation approach. I mean, I'm convinced that, you know, if you can articulate things fairly well and you can have a good interaction with people and express what you do know with clarity and conviction and purpose, that tends to be pretty impressive to people like employers who you might interview with. So I'm talking to high school students, and they're going to be graduating, so I'm trying to kind of give them some motivation in this area. And one of the critiques I had for one of them is, listen, when you're talking in public, when you're doing a presentation, you really don't want to highlight or really put an emphasis on what you don't know, which is exactly what I just did. I put an emphasis on what I'm not really keen on right now. I tend to do that from time to time, but you know, I guess it's one of those things that I have to be reminded that I'm still a student myself in these areas. So, but don't tell my high school class because I want them to think I'm a genius. I got to keep that, you know, that high level of, you know, just kidding. So anyway, today, well, just to give you kind of a timeline framework, I thought about doing PowerPoint to do this, but I had to focus more on just making sure I had the content down in my notes and didn't get a chance to really develop some visuals with this as I would normally like to. But I do have sort of some timeline reference information here that I want to kind of put in front of you so you can kind of be thinking about what's going on in this period of time that we're talking about. Now, we just wrapped up sort of a survey of the period of time in which the Crusades took place, okay? This period of time, just to give you a point of reference, really from a historical vantage point, got underway or was launched in about 1095. And you remember Pope Urban II gave that speech at the Council of Clermont and basically stirred up everybody to begin this movement toward crusade and marching toward Constantinople and down to the Holy Land and freeing the Holy Land from Muslim occupation and rule. That began in 1095 and really spanned all the way till, you know, technically around 1291. If you want to pick a date, that was the date of the fall of Acre in the Holy Land. It was the last remaining stronghold that was held by the Crusaders. It was the last sort of Crusader kingdom territory in the Holy Land, and it fell to the Muslims in 1291. So you have this period of time from 1095 to 1291, which is known as this period of the Crusades. Kind of a big deal. Well, several key sort of periods in history that run parallel together along with the Crusades. And really that's what constitutes some main features of what is called the late Middle Ages or the high Middle Ages, the latter part of the Middle Ages leading up to the Reformation. So all this really should sort of begin to settle in our minds some key seeds that were being sown that would lead to the Reformation. You start thinking about the implications of some of these epical events in this period of time, and they're happening all in parallel to one another, all sort of simultaneously. You can kind of see how there's going to be something that's going to be building. So you have the Crusade period, which is this moment in time where the church begins to wield two swords, as we said. The sword of the Spirit or Scripture, which they didn't necessarily wield it so well, and the sword of war. The church was bearing both swords and justified the bearing of the sword of war using Scripture, really abusing Scripture, and having a theological rationalization for the Crusades. Okay? So you have this manifestation, this very overt, clear manifestation of papal power on display. It's one thing for the church and its primary leader, the Pope, and all the hierarchy under the Pope to have influence over the people, spiritual influence, behavioral influence, emotional manipulation and influence. But now the church is forcefully and massively wielding a sword, a forceful sword of war. That's sort of next level of divine right, if you will, of the church to do this. So the rise of that kind of power is going to have bearing on the thinking and in response to it down the road. This next period of time that we're going to talk about a little bit today is known as the scholastic period, or the period of scholasticism. This period of time ran from 1100 to 1500, 1600, 1700, depending upon where your cutoff is historically. But nonetheless, you've got 1095 to 1291, the period of the Crusades. You got the period of scholasticism that starts in around 1100 and runs all the way up into the period of the Reformation. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the mendicant orders, or the period of theological poverty, of taking vows of poverty in reaction to the church. And this is of a different kind than what we saw in previous periods of time in sort of the monastic orders. This is another type of commitment to poverty as a matter of salvific conscience, of saving genuine Christian faith. In that period of the rise of these mendicant orders, these begging friars who would go and live off of the contributions of people that they would beg from the rich, and then they would evangelize. We'll talk about that, but that period of time was 1200 to 1600. So 1095, 1299, 1291, the Crusades, 1100, 1500, the scholasticism, the rise of mendicant orders, 1200 to 1600. And then you have out of that flowing the Inquisition, the period of the Inquisition, which was 1200 to 1500. So you've got all these sort of big things running parallel historically. Now this period of scholasticism really is tied to the sort of the theological and intellectual thinking of the day that began to emerge in the late Middle Ages. And just to give you a little bit of background, this term scholasticism comes from a Latin word scholasticus, which means that which belongs to the school. This was the period in time in which, for example, universities came onto the scene. Gatherings of masters, of school masters, and their teaching acumen and their teaching appeal would garner the praise and adulation of students who would come under them. So you can kind of think back in prior periods of time, and even before the New Testament periods of time, back in ancient Greece, where you'd have the masters like Plato and Socrates, and they would have students that would follow them around. And you even have that same kind of idea with students having loyalty, even Paul himself sitting under Gamaliel. You have this idea of a prominent teacher. Well, that became a means by which, or a part of contributing factor of this university idea, where you'd have a gathering of schoolmasters, and then they would develop sort of a curriculum, a set curriculum. And really, it was that's where during this period of time where you had that kind of educational framework or system emerged onto the scene. Now, the thing to understand here is that it took place, as I said, beginning in 1100 to 1600, depending upon where your cutoff is. Sort of some of the key focal features of this scholastic period was this sort of this reconciling of philosophy with, you know, ancient classical philosophy even, with Christian theology, with medieval Christian theology. So what happened really during this period of time, what sort of was the impetus of this rise of scholasticism was the sort of the rediscovery of Aristotle. Aristotle was translated into Latin and his writings found their way into the West, into the Latin-speaking world, and it stirred up sort of a renaissance of inquiry and thinking and writing, and this motivation to figure out how to reconcile or merge what was the understood doctrine and theology of the Roman Catholic Church with Aristotelian theological reasoning. Okay, we'll talk about that in just a minute. Hopefully it won't be too tedious and academic, but nevertheless, that's kind of what the period of time was about. In other words, scholasticism was not a philosophical framework in and of itself. In other words, you don't have like, well, I adopt the philosophy of scholasticism as my guide. That's not what it was. Scholasticism was more of a methodology to, as I said, reconcile what became prominently Aristotelian philosophy and the current understood and accepted theology of the day, the theology of the Roman Catholic Church. The fact is that the data of revelation was viewed, the revelation of Scripture and the ecumenical councils and the canons of the church needed to be organized rationally. It needed to be systematically and rationally organized. That was sort of the driving impetus, the driving force. And it needed to carry sort of Aristotle's ideas of deductive logical coherence. It needed to make sense to a logical, rational process, okay? So it was basically oriented toward resolving contradictions as well. In other words, you can't have one thing being something and it also being something else at the same time and them being in contrast, a contradiction to one another. So in the area of theology or doctrine, you had to resolve any observable or known contradictions. So just kind of stay with me. I'm trying to develop this a little bit. As I said, this is not a philosophy or a theology on its own. It was a tool or it was a method for learning. And it put the emphasis on, as I said, Aristotelian ideas of philosophy, or another way to understand this, it's called dialectical reasoning, which is the practice, let me just read this definition, the practice of arriving at a conclusion by the exchange of logical arguments, usually in the form of questions and answers. Now, you might be sitting there thinking, okay, so what? I mean, whatever. This was not common. You didn't do this when this kind of methodology emerged onto the scene. I mean, Aristotelian and Socratic and Platonic methods of thinking and inquiry and study, those were lost in the West for a long period of time. So reintroducing this way of inquiry, of even questioning, well, is this really the way we should understand this particular doctrine, or is there another way to understand? That was not heard of. This is very sort of revolutionary in a sense. So scholastics, though, just to kind of continue to try to put a finer point on it, the scholastics, they weren't necessarily seeking new truth. They were trying to organize the existing body of accepted truth using this dialectical reasoning, this method of questioning and answering and resolving apparent contradictions. So now here's the interesting thing that I think about this. So you have two equally adopted authoritative elements in this methodology of scholasticism. Okay? You have the Bible and the canons and creeds and of the ecumenical councils. You have the writings of the church fathers, authoritative. But also authoritative was the scholastic method of organizing and arranging and rationally understanding these doctrines. So the method itself for studying these things was as authoritative as the things they were studying themselves. And this dialectical process or this logical process was fixed. It became a fixed point of authority. In other words, this is how you did theology. This is how it was done. You don't do it any other way. It had the markings of authority in the same way that the content that they were studying itself had authority. Now, we're going to talk about this a little bit. We'll see this play out a little bit with some of the key figures of the time. But I know that I might not have done the best job of kind of explaining this. It's not the easiest thing to kind of get your head around all the time. But do you see any problems potentially with this on the face of it, just by what I've feebly described? What are some potential problems out of the gate?
Man's reasoning is equal to Scripture.
Yeah.
How else to state that?
That's probably the biggest thing. Is that basically you're elevating, which is already a problem, because you had that going on. It just wasn't stated as a formal methodology for learning. But when you have the Pope as the Vicar of Christ, who is the consummate representative on earth of Christ himself, who carries the authority of Christ himself, you can then marshal people to do things like go on a crusade and kill other people in the name of Christ as part of gospel mission. So that kind of thing was already taking place. This basically formalized that in sort of an academic methodology around the subject matter of theology. But think about that. Think about introducing into the public domain in a period of time when university education begins to emerge onto the scene, these ideas of questioning, these ideas of resolving contradiction, things are just, that doesn't make sense. This can't be this and this at the same time. They're in conflict with one another. So this idea of just putting that into the public domain for consumption and thought and debate and discussion in a manner in which people learned was, can you see how that would be a seed to Reformation at some point in the future, right? No one's just sort of adopting everything, or everyone's not just adopting everything as you just don't ever question it. It is what it is. The practice itself that they're introducing through this Aristotelian philosophy and the approach that it followed in doing theology introduced the idea of just asking questions and trying to resolve contradictions. But, to your point, it also elevated man's reason, his ability to do that to the nth degree. So there's all kinds of problems that we could see emerging with this and all kinds of extremes that could develop as a result of this. But the bottom line is that this methodology took root. It became prominent. Now, just as any other period of time, you have a spectrum that develops. You have sort of a spectrum of different, you know, people landing on different points of that spectrum in terms of how they engaged in this scholastic methodology for doing theology, for understanding the already revealed truth that they had. And again, remember, revealed authoritative truth was not just Scripture. It was Scripture, it was the creeds from the ecumenical councils, and it was whatever the doctrines and canons were established from the church and written by the patristic fathers. All of that was authoritative. So you've already got a problem with your source of authority and merging a bunch of things that might not necessarily be in agreement with one another. But nevertheless, that was the source of authority. So there's already an acceptance of that, but then there's also an elevation of this methodology, this approach for arranging or organizing logically all of this theology, all of this material. How do we understand it? Now, this is an interesting time because you would think that just doing that alone, just introducing the idea of a formal practice and a formal venue for inquiry, for questioning, for even acknowledging that these things are contradictory, they can't be both one and the same. I mean, you can't have both of these sit side by side and say they both are true because they conflict with one another. Just the very fact that you're introducing the possibility of that, you know, your mind might go to a place of saying, well, man, it seems like the Reformation would have started like 5 minutes after that. But that's not the case, because the scholastics still embraced and supported the papal monarchy. They didn't, in other words, this approach was oriented towards supporting in a different kind of formalized academic philosophic way what was already in the public domain in terms of the known doctrines of the church. And that included the clerical hierarchy of the church, starting with the vicar of Christ himself and working its way down through the rest of the clergy. So it was all oriented towards supporting that initially. In fact, it was also during this period of time that emerged the canon, the canons of the church, the formal canons of the church, that became law, basically. You remember you're living in a period of time in sort of a Holy Roman Empire where the church is the kingdom and the kingdom is the church, and there was always this back and forth between, is the king the one with divine right and authority, or is the pope the one with divine right and authority? And of course the pope would say, well, you know, divinity comes before earthly things, and so I'm the divine. You know, that, all that was sort of continually in play, and at this period of time, the Pope had tremendous authority throughout the empire at that period of time, throughout the known world, actually, at that point of time, aside from the Muslim world. And so the scholastic method was oriented toward supporting that, and out of that came these canon laws that basically formalized and gave legal reference points for everything that the church was and wanted to do and wanted to enforce. And it ranged from every subject of things like war all the way to relationships and marriage and any other sort of civil contract. So this particular period of time had both of these kinds of principles sort of in play. It had this principle of formalizing and in one sense giving more authority and more power in a more documented, systematized rule of law kind of process and production of material, a body of canon law that's organized, it's consolidated. In other words, all these different things that had come out of all these different councils and all these different principles that were advocated by all these different popes over time, all these different writings and all these different patristic fathers' theology and all that, to kind of formalize that and consolidate that and systematize that and organize that and arrange that, as long as it's done from the standpoint of supporting the existing structure, in a sense, it gave more power and authority, more organized power and authority to the existing structure. But at the same time, the process itself, the fundamental elements of inquiry and questioning and even acknowledging that there's contradiction that needs to be resolved, was seeds for what was to come simultaneously. Are you tracking me? Am I saying that in a way that makes sense? You have both of these things kind of in play at the same time. So who were some of the big players during this period of time? I think you'll recognize a few of the names. I only have a few for the sake of time and just really wanting to be representative. But Anselm Does that name ring a bell? Have you heard of Anselm? Anselm was a scholastic during this period of time. He lived from 1033 to 1109. Anselm was born in northern Italy. He was educated in France, and he eventually became the Archbishop of Canterbury in England. Canterbury Tales, Chaucer, all that. He was the Archbishop of Canterbury. Became Archbishop of Canterbury in England in 1093. Now, Anselm basically applied the ideas of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle to his theological work. And those ideas, and again, I'm going to have to kind of dabble a little bit in some philosophy. And all of you guys remember your Platonic philosophy, right, from schooling or whatever, and your Socratic philosophy and Aristotelian ideas. So what Anselm did was he took this idea that really was most prominently put forward by Plato. Obviously, it was seeded by Socrates, and Plato formalized it. Aristotle had a little bit of a different version of this, and we'll talk about that in a second. But this idea that universals exist before created things. Universals exist before created things. That was the idea. So an example would be, a good deed is simply a shadow or reflection of the reality of goodness. Goodness is the ultimate reality. The universal goodness is the ultimate reality. Don't doze off on me. Stay with me. Goodness is the ultimate reality. A good deed is just a shadow or reflection of that. It's not substantively as real as the reality of goodness. Okay? So Anselm sort of bought into that idea that this kind of ultimate idea, these ultimate universals, are what are ultimately real, and they exist objectively apart from the practical things. The practical good deed has something that it's a shadow reflection of something that exists totally separate from it, which is this ultimate universal reality called goodness. So that's kind of how to understand in a simple way this idea of universals that exist before created things. Now, Augustine had some of these ideas in his writings centuries before, so this was not brand new territory, but Anselm really brought it to bear in a significant way. It was a view that became known as realism, and you can kind of get the idea of Anselm's approach to theology like this in the statement that he wrote. It was in Latin, so I'm going to give you the English version. He said this: I believe in order that I may know. I believe in order that I may know. So in other words, when it comes to theology, there is the universal reality of God, as an example. So I believe in the universal reality, and from that I might know everything else. I believe in order that I may know. You might have heard of Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God. Yes? No? Don't say yes, because I'm going to ask you to state it. Everybody's going, no, I don't know. I had to be reminded of it, but it's pretty well known in philosophic circles. In fact, debates often kind of, people who are atheistic in their orientation will often try to, you know, tackle the ontological argument, Anselm's ontological argument, and sort of do away with it immediately, you know, as a point of reference. But anyway, here's kind of the gist of that, of Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God. Again, based upon this idea of universals existing separate and ultimate and representing ultimate reality apart from the earthly created things. So here's the ontological argument. Everyone has an idea of a perfect supreme being in mind. Use your mind and imagine this perfect supreme being. In other words, that concept can come into most people's minds. Some idea of perfection and supreme existence. Everyone has an idea of a perfect supreme being in mind. This idea must correspond to a reality that has an objective existence. So in other words, the idea that can come to my, that I can conjure up in my mind is the shadow or the reflection of an ultimate reality. You see the connection there with Platonic philosophy. This idea must correspond to reality that has an objective existence. For such a being, lacking existence would not be perfect. Nor would it be supreme. Meaning that which nothing greater can be conceived. So, if you can conceive of a perfect supreme being, but then you immediately go to the place that it doesn't exist, then you have not conceived of a perfect supreme being, because existence is a necessary element of supremacy and perfection. Mind's blown, right? All right. So he says, because no greater idea than that of God as the perfect supreme being can be conceived, God must exist in reality. Okay? So that's the ontological argument. That's sort of the gist of Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God. Now he's employing this Platonic view of this existence of universals as the ultimate reality that exists apart from created things. And he's just deploying that within the context of an understanding of God. If we can conceive of the idea, then there must be an ultimate reality that this idea is merely the shadow or reflection of. For it not to be in reality existent as a universal concept, it ceases to be supreme or perfect. So how can those two things exist? In other words, therein lies your internal contradiction. If you are someone who would say, yeah, of course I can think of a perfect and supreme being. I mean, I can imagine that in my head. But then I immediately dismiss it and say, but it doesn't exist. You have broken the law of contradiction in that statement, because existence is a necessary component of perfection and supremacy. Okay? So it's fascinating to think of it that way. Now, this becomes problematic, though. Not just the argument itself, but the approach. Why would I say that? Why do you think I might say that this is problematic?
Because there's such a diverse viewpoint between your view and my view in terms of what that level is.
It definitely puts the concept in each individual's mind, right? I mean, you're conceptualizing something. Well, how do we know what is perfection in your mind? What is supremacy? I mean, you're talking about having to kind of universalize even that to a degree. Yeah.
Assumes that Plato, what he said was true, or it's based on that reason?
Well, yeah, I mean, the idea would be that Plato was getting at the truth. And, you know, it's the idea that all truth is God's truth. So even a pagan, you know, polytheistic, idol-worshipping pagan can still express the truth that is God's truth, the idea. The problem, though, where I think a huge problem, kind of goes back to this elevating of reason, is it's a theological problem. In other words, we're going to do theology, but we're going to not do theology as our starting point for doing theology. The starting point for doing theology is the eternal, totally independent, and autonomous existence of a creator God, and the reality of fallen man who cannot make his way to God, who cannot fully apprehend God, who cannot relate properly to God apart from a sovereign work of God in the person of Jesus Christ. So in other words, our understanding, our true understanding of the true God has to come from God himself. We cannot ascend in our own minds and our own rational thinking to the heights of a true and accurate understanding of God. That must come through revelation by God himself. So basically we're saying we're going to do theology by not doing theology, and somehow we're going to end up doing theology. It's logically inconsistent in of itself. I know that was kind of a circular idea, but it's basically your starting point is your mind. Like Fred said, I'm starting in your mind. We're starting in my mind. Well, that's a broken starting point. Before you even utter your concept about what a supreme perfect being looks like, it's broken. You're not going to get to some universal true reality out there. It's broken. You're going to do theology by not starting with theology. Theology starts with an autonomous, pre-existent, eternal God who reveals himself, who shows up and says, I am God, let there be light. I mean, that's where it all begins. It doesn't begin with, you know, some concept of God in our minds, and we apprehend him and thereby get at what the reality of God is. Okay, so there again, Anselm is imbibing Platonic philosophy and doing theology according to that, and it starts to break down because of the requirements of revelation. So that's one school of sort of thought, one sort of branch. You have another guy named Peter Abelard. Have you heard of Peter Abelard? It's kind of a name rings a bell to some people. Peter Abelard lived from 1079 to 1142. He was a native of Brittany in France. He became famous. This guy was a phenomenal teacher. He had thousands of students that wanted to come hear him lecture on theology. He really pushed the envelope in this whole idea of the scholastic method of asking questions and resolving contradictions and resolving contradictions within the realm of theology and within the realm of revealed and accepted truth. His position became known as moderate realism. He believed that reality first existed in the mind of God, then it exists here and now in individuals, rather than being sort of separate on their own, like Anselm and Plato. They exist, these ultimate universals exist on their own. It begins in the mind of God, but then it does, in fact, exist here and now in individuals and in things, and finally in man's mind. So in other words, his starting point is with God, but ultimately truth and reality exists in man's mind as well. And his credo, a slight variation from Anselm's, I believe in order that I may know, Abelard would say, I know in order that I may believe. So he would put his ability to know as a precursor or a predetermining factor to his ability to believe. He would elevate the priority of knowledge as a pathway toward belief and faith. He emphasized reason in the development of truth. And he believed that doubt would lead to inquiry, which would ultimately lead to truth. So in other words, doubting and questioning was the pathway toward the truth. Again, that was ground that wasn't covered for centuries. So he's introducing something that is new. He wrote his seminal work was called Sic et Non, which is simply translated yes and no. And in that book, he wrote out 158 propositions that arranged to show the pros and cons or the contradictions in the patristic fathers, the early church fathers' writings. 158 propositions of contradiction that existed in the writings of the early church. And that process alone, by putting that forward and wrestling with those contradictions, was the way to get at what's true. The mind of man can get there. He said this, it's by doubting that we come to investigate, and by investigating that we recognize the truth. Again, so a very high view of man's rational faculties to apprehend ultimate truth. Again, just a reminder, this scholastic process was existing in the realm of theology. It was not some just academic exercise of what you would consider more secular disciplines. So that was Peter Abelard. And then you have Thomas Aquinas, and we'll wrap up with him. Thomas Aquinas, I'm sure you've heard of Thomas Aquinas, right? That's a familiar name to many people. From 1225 to 1274, Aquinas was a Dominican monk. He brilliant mind, just wrote volumes and volumes and volumes. He was similar to Abelard. He valued and honored reason above all other human attributes. He distinguished himself, though, because he had a greater sort of commitment to the church. In other words, that came out in the way that he approached theology and doing theology in this scholastic method was his clear advocacy and promotion of the church, whereas Abelard was more engaged in the academic exercise and the philosophical debate. Aquinas was more committed to supporting the doctrines and tenets of the church and the organization, the institution of the church, I should say. He wrote his sort of his magnum opus was his Summa Theologica, or a summation of theological knowledge. This is a major sort of Catholic systematic theology. I mean, it's a massive tome. And he did it in the form of questions and answers. It's got a view of the whole universe. The God is, and the content of theology is part God himself and part other beings as far as they are ordained unto God, he says. He made a clear distinction between theology and philosophy and reason and revelation, so he drew lines in between those two things. So it's interesting how, you know, you if you find yourself sort of trying to do theology, and you're immersed in a philosophical, purely philosophical framework, you kind of find yourself and your thinking and your approach descending into these forced categories of, for example, separating, drawing a distinction between reason and doctrine, between reason and theology, that they're two separate things. Well, why? I mean, why do they have to be separate? Can you rationalize that for me? So it's a whole other point of discussion there, but he made a clear distinction between the two. Distinction between reason and revelation, that's a good distinction. But he said there's no contradiction between the two. Both are fountains of knowledge. Both come from the same God. He says the two differ in their methods of searching after truth. Reason is based upon the visible creation and can reach ideas that deal with the vestibule of faith, he says. Revelation looks to God, and he is in himself, as he is in himself, and so is superior to reason, both in its certainty and in its subject matter. Okay, so again, just creating categories that are not necessary or essential, especially to really do biblical theology. He says reason, for example, can prove God's existence. He accepted Aristotle's principle that every effect has a cause and every cause a prior cause and so on back to the first cause. But he declared that creation traces back to a divine first cause, the Creator. So that's where the Aristotelian philosophy kind of comes into play with Aquinas. Just kind of as another note here, he basically, in the Summa Theologica, he formalized sort of the key doctrines of the church in a way that were already kind of in place, but he basically put theological and organizational structure around the ideas of, for example, the Trinity, saving grace that comes exclusively through the channel of divinely appointed sacraments placed in the keeping of the church. So basically it was Thomas Aquinas who infused rational philosophical theology into the doctrines of the church in such a way that formalized the doctrines of the sacraments as being the channel of grace and salvation that was kept by the church itself. So you can see how that would lend itself to Aquinas' view that the institution of the church needed to be preserved and protected and guarded, even in this process of doing theology from a philosophical perspective. So, again, we're out of time. I know that's kind of tedious academic and philosophical kind of information that I don't even necessarily fully understand. I haven't got my mind around completely either. But the bottom line is you have this period of time where this kind of theology and academic exercise is getting underway. This idea of questioning, of inquiry, of doing theology and saying it needed to make rational sense, that contradictions needed to be resolved. Obviously, it wasn't devoid of problems, but nevertheless, it planted those seeds where you could see how Reformation could eventually get underway.